Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects. We're coming to you live from Firehouse World in San Diego. And today we're going to look at a variety of topics concerning the apparatus industry. We have hosts Tom Shin and Mike Wilbur. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Pete. To all our listeners, it's Mike and Tom out here, as Pete said, in sunny San Diego. So when you live where we live in downstate and upstate New York, being out in San Diego here for a couple of days, even when they had their reputed winter storm, which consisted of some high winds and some rain, we'll take that every day as compared to the kind of weather we got at home. So here's our rundown today to our listeners. We're going to talk a little bit about some recent accidents, which has become a staple. Unfortunately, despite our best efforts in training and retraining, we continue to have incidents out there. Brother Mike's going to take us through some of those. We're then going to talk at length about weights of apparatus, in-service units, new units, what you can could and should be doing to protect yourself prior to having any type of unfortunate incident. And then we're going to wrap up our session today with just talking about a little bit of industry news and some questions from our listeners. So, Mike, what do you have for us? So what's been going on here in terms of apparatus accidents here in the last couple of weeks?
Well, we start out, Tom, with the middle of last month. There was an apparatus struck in Connecticut. The fire department had a spare apparatus while the frontline piece was having a computer installed. And the crew stated they couldn't believe their eyes as a car was headed directly at them in their lane. The apparatus came to a complete stop before being hit head-on by the car. The driver and the officer both stated the driver of the car was leaning way over into the passenger side, appearing to be attempting to pick something up off the floor. The woman who was driving that car was injured, and the guys on the engine company in Connecticut rendered first aid. Another stark example of driver inattentiveness out there that we have to drive around. Apparatus crash during driver training in West Virginia. Two firefighters were treated for minor injuries after a fire truck slid on a patch of ice and landed submerged into a creek. According to a public relations officer, two firefighters were conducting driver training in a brush truck around noon when the driver hit an icy patch. The fire truck toppled over its side off of a bridge and landed into Beaver Creek and submerged in about 4 feet of water. The two firefighters were able to crawl out of the windshield and save themselves. Both were transported with minor injuries and released.
You know, Mike, you've often talked about, driver training during times of adverse weather conditions, and not just when it's nice and sunny as it is out here in San Diego, and 2 o'clock in the afternoon when there's very limited traffic and the roads are bare and dry. What kind of guidelines do you think? I mean, it sounds to me like these folks, even though it sounded innocent that they were taking a brush unit out, that certainly it sounds like the weather conditions were potentially not very, very favorable. Any guidelines you could offer our listeners, saying if you're going to go embark in some training when the weather is not necessarily favorable, what are some of the things that you should be looking to either do or, more importantly, not do to reinforce to make that this training doesn't end up in an incident like this where they end up, dumping the rig in the drink?
Yeah, Tom, you're absolutely correct. A couple of points that are noteworthy about this. One, the bridge did not have a guard rail, where local residents had complained about that. And in the words of one spokesman, the road is extremely dangerous during inclement weather, and if a vehicle begins to slide, there's nowhere you can go except into the creek. Yes, we are firm believers that you need to have some kind of program where you can put fire trucks and firefighters behind the wheel of those trucks driving in inclement weather. But common sense needs to prevail. Going on one lane, dangerous roads, across bridges that are known to freeze before anything else, without a guardrail, certainly wouldn't be a place to start out with driver training. However, on a flat surface, potentially maybe even in a parking lot, to get the feel of the apparatus before you venture out onto a roadway and then go on roadways that have been properly treated or are wide and straight and not some narrow winding country road with two caverns for ditches on either side that are just inviting you and the apparatus to go off the road and to go into. So you have to take a common sense approach. You know, a couple 3 inches of snow on a fairly wide two-lane road that's fairly flat is one thing. Going on a one-lane twisty-turny road in an ice storm is certainly another, and common sense has to prevail. We move on now. Probably the most tragic incident of all this past month. Two firefighters from Kilgore, Texas, were killed in the line of duty when they were ejected from a tower ladder. And for many luminaries in the fire service, some really smart people, when they were approached with, do tower ladder buckets need to have some kind of restraints in them? Is it part of the standard? Is it not part of the standard? And a whole discussion began surrounding that issue. But in any event, as for the event itself, there are a couple of rounded hooks on the bottom of the bucket that got entangled into a building that they were using for training. The operator at the controls of the bucket evidently put pressure on the bucket. It tore part of the building away, and the bucket then acted as a catapult. It's our understanding that the operator of the machine held onto the controls. He was not hurt. There was another firefighter that was ejected and actually crushed between the bucket of the tower ladder into the wall that saved him, although he was injured, but not too seriously. And then the two firefighters that were ejected, again, it was relayed to us that it was about an 8-story fall. And both of those firefighters were killed, a 45-year-old and a 26-year-old firefighter. And certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to the Kilgore, Texas Fire Department and the families of those firefighters.
You know, Mike, something comes to the mind for both that, the tragedy of that incident, as well as the incident where the two fellows were out driver training in the mini pumper. Is part of that, to me, comes to be, you know, supervision from either a training officer or a command officer, whoever in those particular departments oversees that. It would seem to me that while that training officer, you know, in the case of the mini pumper, probably wasn't the person riding along with the driver trainee, that there needs to be at least a review of, you know, if you're going to have a driver training during adverse weather, maybe there's a set prescribed course that's approved by the department so that people know where the unit's going to be, and you kind of avoid the near occasion of sin of taking even a small brush unit over a unprotected bridge over a creek, so that you don't get anywhere near something that could get you in trouble. And I guess more significantly to me on the training for the tower ladder, again, while the departmental training officer or whoever the supervisor is, you know, maybe was not physically there, it would seem that you'd have a policy or protocol and make sure that safety equipment, for the lack of a safety belt, unfortunately, caused the untimely death of those two fellas. That type of equipment would be in place, and there'd be a policy to say that, you know, you don't raise the bucket up. I can remember for years attending different fire apparatus trade shows when units would be positioned outside and they'd be giving, quote, free rides to potential customers or you know, you'd see a you know a firefighter come up with his wife and his two young kids and want to go for a little spin in the tower. You'd have to supply the appropriate safety equipment for those folks. If we would supply it for them, it seems kind of ludicrous to me initially to think that we would, even though if you're in bunker gear, if you're six or seven or eight stories up, something bad happens, you don't have anything to protect yourself there.
That's a really great point, Tom. And, of course, we've spoke about it on different occasions, whether it's on this radio program or in training sessions that we conduct. And, of course, one question always is, who's training the trainer? What kind of training does that individual have? And you and I both know, particularly when it comes to aerial devices, there are many departments that are buying them as the country grows and expands. With not ever having any kind of aerial device in their fleet before. And they really count on the manufacturer. Well, the manufacturers are only obligated under the standard to teach you how to operate the controls of the truck. And in fact, if I'm correct, and you can correct me on this, Tom, but I believe the standard was actually changed at one time where they actually took the word training out, and it's called a demonstration now? Is that?
I'm not sure, Mike, what the appropriate language is, but that's in the standard, but you're correct. It's more people would refer to it as familiarization training, that here's how you can safely set up and operate the unit on flat ground. They should be able to show you how to operate it when the terrain is not level, how you could on an aerial device short jack the unit when it's required, but typically that is, as you mentioned, it's familiarization training on here's how the device operates, here's what it can do, probably a significant list of here's things you shouldn't be doing with the unit. But if you purchase an aerial ladder, particularly a device that's with a tower or a unit that has a waterway, that training typically will not involve any driving or movement or positioning of the apparatus to show you how to effectively position it on the fire ground. And if the unit's equipped with a waterway or it has a fire pump on it, it's reasonably unusual, at least from my observations, that the people are going to run water through the tower and do that kind of stuff. It's basically going to be, here's how you operate it, and I think, Mike, as you've alluded to in the past, but this is the way our society is going, here's the way to operate this unit, so we give you the training so that you won't sue us when something bad happens. And I think, to me, as evidenced in these cases, even with the best of intentions, I can assure you that the manufacturer doesn't do this training just to give you, you know, bum information or to say in the bid specs you were obligated to have 3 8-hour training sessions. They're not looking to count down to the, you know, 23rd hour so they can pack up, get out of Dodge, get their check, and run over the hill. They want the people to feel confident in the operation of the unit. But even if you sat through these training programs, which tend to be repetitive, so that if you had 2 days of training or 3 days of training, other than some ancillary training for the mechanics or preventative maintenance issues on the rigs, it's generally you get 1 8-hour session and then you'd bring a second group within your department for the second class. That certainly doesn't make you an expert in the operation of the device within that 8-hour period, particularly if you're in an organization, as you mentioned, that didn't have one of these before. You know, no disrespect to the departments that are, you know, have seen fit to go provide ladder company service in whatever fashion, but if you didn't own one of these devices in the beginning, you're unfortunately going to find yourself sadly short of the mark if you simply rely on the training that's afforded by the manufacturer. That's good stuff, and to tell you how to operate the device once it's stopped and stationary and typically level, but all those other fire ground factors that get thrown at you, operating in heavy smoke conditions, limited lighting conditions, in conditions where people have parked civilian vehicles or other fire department or first response vehicles that have parked and now make the positioning of the apparatus more difficult. Mike and I were having dinner the other evening with Gordon Routley, and we were discussing aerial positions in other parts of the country, and there's some areas where people feel that their positioning of the apparatus is enhanced by backing in to the building and parking at what appears to be a 45-degree angle all the time. And because in history somebody told them that's the best thing to do, that's now been taken as gospel for 15 or 20 years, and all apparatus positioning in that department's fire ground scenarios looks like that. And unfortunately, I think the people have just, they've maybe taken it too far, that they haven't been exposed to other proper ways or other ways in which you can position the rigs, Mike, and to just simply rely on the manufacturer's training. That's like, if we're talking about stepping stones, and there's four or five stepping stones to get across the shallow creek from the one bank to the other, the manufacturer's training maybe gets you to the second one, you know. And if that's as far as you go, that's as far as your training's going to take you. It's going to be, unfortunately, then up to yourself to figure out how to get across those other three stones. And if you don't secure some other department's assistance that has run aerials or secure some outside training from someone, you're going to find yourself probably a little bit less than halfway across the creek and a little left to figure the rest out for yourself.
Yeah, and there's plenty of people out there that can conduct good training sessions on these vehicles, and certainly our advice is to seek someone out that knows what they're doing with this stuff so that you can maximize that $1 million expenditure when you get the vehicle on the fire ground. Good points, Tom. To continue on, two die in a collision with an ambulance. This occurred in Florida. Was late at night. The was already a collision. The ambulance driver attempted to avoid the collision, but could not. And there'll be more information on that event later. And as Tom alluded to earlier, we are in sunny San Diego. However, it's been in the upper Midwest and certainly in the Northeast where we hail from. It has been a very snowy, cold, icy winter. And the next incident occurred in Fairfax County when somebody fell through the ice, and while treating the patient, the park fire engine began sliding toward them and ran almost into the crew before coming to rest on a tree. Amazingly, nobody was hurt, but the apparatus just slid, even with the maxi brake on, just slid on the ice. So for all the firefighters out there, operators, engineers, in those jurisdictions that have snow and ice, please be careful the next couple of months before we get to spring. In Kentucky, firefighters survive an apparatus crash wearing seatbelts, and a civilian driver was charged with DUI drugs. Two members of a volunteer fire department were transported to the hospital after their tanker overturned on the way to a fire. They were responding to a report of a possible gas explosion and garage fire at 1 p.m. on Tuesday. While the truck was on the way to the fire, they encountered an eastbound maroon GMC Jimmy. And according to Kentucky State Police report, that driver of that Jimmy refused to yield to the emergency vehicle. The GMC then veered into the westbound lane, and the fire truck lost control and ran off the road, overturning. The road is really treacherous, and the weather made the road slick. They administered a breathalyzer test, and the driver of the SUV was charged with driving under the influence of drugs. And the passenger, a passenger in the SUV, however, was not arrested. The injuries to the firefighters were not believed to be critical. And a lot, and we talked about this, I believe, last month, Tom, in this case, both of the firefighters on board this apparatus were wearing seatbelts that certainly probably saved their lives. There was a fatal apparatus crash in Florida, in California, not too far from where we are in Riverside County. A pickup truck crashed, killing a woman. The crash was reported just after 500 hours. They were responding to a run when the crash happened. They were traveling south and crashed with a pickup truck, which was traveling west in a cross street. The driver of the pickup truck was pronounced dead at the scene. A fire captain and firefighter suffered moderate injuries and were taken to a hospital for observation. And then finally, of this month, Super Hole Sunday in Jersey City. On Sunday of the Super Bowl, a Jersey City ladder truck was responding, and temperatures finally got above freezing. And as they were responding, the roadway gave way, which I think, Tom, is a symptom of a much more serious problem that we need to discuss.
Well, Mike, you know, you mentioned about just in the earlier incident about people intoxicated running into a fire truck. As most of our listeners are aware, at least at this time last Thursday, there was a very tragic aircraft incident where a plane went down in Clarence Center, New York, which is reasonably close to where I live in the Hamburg area, and it occurred late at night. And just a couple of just thoughts about that, beyond the fact that, again, our thoughts and prayers are extended out to the 50 families that lost loved ones during that incident. The first one that comes to mind is where the plane went down in a largely residential area was within, by all accounts, less than half a mile from the fire station. And for those people that are listeners that are in the volunteer service, you've probably at some point in your career made a run where you got from work, home, or wherever you happened to be when the pager went off to respond to the station, to get your gear on and then get in the rig, as Mike and I have preached for a long time, you know, sit down, you know, buckle up, you know, put your SCBA on and get ready to go to work. When an incident occurs very, very close to where the station is, in this case in the Clarence Center, New York Fire Station, you've got very, very little reaction time. And for those firefighters and the first responders that went to that run that had, less than a minute to kind of get their thoughts gathered where they thought they were initially maybe going in on either a house fire or a report of a plane down, to find a commercial aircraft down with multiple fatalities, it really begins to take you back. So that's one thing. The other thing, when you mentioned about the intoxicated person driving the GMC that encountered the fire truck, during the ensuing 3 or 4 days after the incident, the state police, the local law enforcement authorities obviously had that immediate area locked down pretty tightly to dissuade private citizens, sightseers from coming into the area to disturb what was certainly considered legally to be a crime scene from an investigative standpoint, as well as when they had even initially not begin to get into the body recovery. Over a period of the first 72 hours, while the state police admitted that, you know, overall the people in the area and the citizens reacted very, very well, there were three folks that it hit the national news that were arrested for trying to get through those lines. One young fellow was found hiding behind a house with the video camera. He was a private citizen and just trying to sneak into the area to get some souvenirs and to take some videotape, probably to go sell it to a news outlet. Well, he was promptly arrested. The two things that really got me is at one of the traffic checkpoints where the sheriff and state police were stopping people, and this was during the daytime, this was not nighttime hours, one gentleman was immediately arrested after he became belligerent, got out of his vehicle, and had a physical altercation with one of the law enforcement officials, and after a few seconds had determined this gentleman was intoxicated. The best one was the gentleman who showed up at one of these traffic checkpoints, again, not in the evening hours, but during the daytime hours, early morning hours actually, and did not want to stop, and as soon as he rolled the window down to kind of mouth off to the police, they immediately pegged him as being way over the legal limit and was drunk. So you would think that if you were drunk, the last thing you would do would be come into a law enforcement traffic checkpoint to try to find out where you wanted to go. So the fact of, you know, when we're out operating at any kind of incident, unless we have safely secured the scene and the public highway, just because it's 11 a.m. in the morning doesn't necessarily mean that the guy approaching you is going to, you know, be sober in any state. And some of the incidents that you've cited and some of those things that happened most recently up in my neck of the woods just kind of goes to prove to that point that if you're that wasted that you're coming up to the traffic checkpoint where a normal person would think, I don't think I want to encounter a police officer right now, that two of these clowns went right in there and then began to mouth off to the cops. And fortunately, the good local law enforcement people took it upon themselves to promptly arrest these people and impound their vehicles. So we in the fire service should not think, you know, anything different when we see an approaching vehicle coming into one of our scenes and unless we have secured it properly. So to get into your weight issue here, one of the many changes that occurred with the NFPA 1901-2009 edition is the fact that now the standard requires that every piece of apparatus that we have in our fleet be weighed annually. Now, some people may think, geez, well, what's up with this weighed annually unit? Well, I guess let's try to relate this to the last time, and I'll be the first to admit, I'm not really enamored to go to see my general family physician any more often than I'm absolutely mandated to. But if you think about when you go in, even if you're sick, and you go to the doctor, and after you've waited the appropriate amount of time, and they say, Mr. Shand, Dr. So-and-so will see you right now, and you come in and you get into the inner sanctum in the office, what's the first thing they do? Now, the nurse typically will weigh you and take your blood pressure. It's kind of just making sure that whatever you tell the doctor your symptoms might be, they've got some kind of baseline because they've done that before. And if you're telling them that you're feeling great and, you know, they look at you have elevated blood pressure and, oh, my, by the way, you've just gained 18 pounds since your last visit 6 months ago, that might be the sign that there's something else going on there. Well, I think we need to take that same approach with our fire apparatus. I can tell our listeners that in the locations throughout the country that Mike and I have visited where the people have asked us to come in and take a look at their fleet and do like a fleet analysis and try to get them on the semblance of an apparatus replacement program. In the last 8 to 10 years, there's only been one community out of the many that we have visited that we could say if we, when you went to weigh each of their in-service units, they came away with what we would call in the medical profession a clean bill of health. In all the other communities, there was at least one, and Mike encountered recently one that in a fleet that had about a dozen and a half units, there were 7 units that were suspect. 3 of those 7 were overweight. The way they sat in the fire station with nobody in it before you put any personnel in it, and the balance of the units, if you loaded up the personnel in each of the seats, it would have been severely overloaded. And these were not units that were 20 and 30 years old. These were some rigs purchased within the last 8 to 10 years in some cases. So I think the NFPA in their strong wisdom here, the 1901 committee, is telling us that like ourselves in our personal lives, as we grow older, we tend to not keep our same weight, or as they would call it, fighting weight or lose weight. We tend to gain weight. That same thing happens to the fire trucks. So here's some few things that Mike and I believe that you should do. One, if you do not have current weight certificates, and some people would say, well, where do you go get your fire truck weighed? Well, there's a couple things you can do. Most of the times, your local law enforcement or police agency will have scales that you can, on a level ground, can plop the unit up on the scales on each tire, and you can get a weight that way. That works well, but you have to make sure that the unit is on reasonably level ground. Another way to do it is if you have a concrete facility in your community or an adjacent community or a sand and gravel enterprise. Any one of the large industries typically have scales that you can drive the whole fire truck up on. And if you have one of those scales available to you, what you need to do is to bring the unit over to one of those scales and drive it so the front axle is first up on the scale. Get the driver to hop off and get a weight on the front axle. Then you're going to get back in the rig and pull the whole unit onto the scale so you get the weight of the entire vehicle. And then you're going to get back in again and drive so the front axle is off but the rear axle is on the scale to get a rear axle weight. Now, some of our listeners might say, why do I need to get this 3 times? Well, it's one thing to say we need to know the weight of the whole apparatus because you can take the front gross axle weight rating and the rear, total those together, and hopefully your fire truck is going to weigh less than what that number is. But as Mike and I have found in a number of cases, the unit may be compliant with the overall gross vehicle weight rating, but may indeed be overweight on individually the front or the rear axle, and in some cases significantly it's on both. So you need to get those weights, and once you establish that baseline, then you do that every year. Because again, most of us, our apparatus does not shed or lose weight. We add equipment weight and payload weight as we go through. So
Tom, where would I look for the axle weights on the unit itself, where I could compare the weight tickets that you just told us to get with the actual axle weights?
Good question. On any unit recently purchased, certainly within the last 20 to 25 years, it's normally within the driver's compartment area on the left side of the cab. Different manufacturers put it in different locations. In some cases, when you open up the driver's door, it is inside the door jamb. That's a sticker that will tell you what the axle weight rating capacities are. In some cases, it may be, for example, if you have a Spartan cabin chassis, you hop up in the seat and you flip down the sun visor, and in the headliner underneath the sun visor is the sticker that has all of that information. On other brands of units, it may be prominently labeled and be on the vertical surface of the engine box. On an older unit that was a canopy cab unit where it had the old-style firewall or dividing wall between the front and the rear, it typically is behind the driver's seat on that firewall or divider wall area. But every fire truck will have it in some fashion. If you had your unit rebuilt, repainted, maybe recabbed, it was a rebuilt unit and you went from a two-door cab to a four-door cab, the front axle may have changed, and you can't find that sticker for whatever reason inside the cab, you can always go back to the original delivery manual, which will have the axle ratings in there. And as a third option, you can go for the original Underwriters Laboratories or the independent pump certification sheets, and the axle ratings are indicated on that as well. So there should be at least three different places. One place physically on a fire truck, two places within your filing system for that piece of apparatus where you're gonna find that information. And you need to get that. If you've never done it, you need to do that on every unit in the fleet. There are no exclusions here. It could be a tender that you say, geez, you know, that unit doesn't ever run on an emergency or a code 3 response, so we don't have to worry about it. No, you weigh everything in your fleet, from the small utility truck to the brush truck. There just simply are no exclusions here. And you get those weights on the front and the rear axle, and then you measure that against what the unit is capable of carrying, and you find out whether you're in trouble or not. We would hope to our listeners that you wouldn't find any units that are in trouble, but I can tell you from Mike's and my past humble experience, we have yet on only one occasion been surprised in that we did not find a unit that was overloaded. And that brings us to, you know, why did the NFPA come forth with this? Are they, you know, just trying to make our life, you know, more difficult? No, we're trying to prevent ourselves from getting involved in an unfortunate incident and then find out, and Mike, you can speak to this, you know, if I'm driving a fire truck and I get involved in a wreck, and let's suppose, it does make a difference whether it's a, you know, I'm a volunteer or whether I'm a career personnel and getting a paycheck for this, if I'm involved with a significant accident with the vehicle, what kind of things can I expect to happen to me? I mean, because I'm a fireman and we should know all the cops in town, I mean, I'm going to get a pass. Are they going to pull me off and do a drug test on me, or they're just going to say, hey, that it's, you know, old friendly Tom was driving a fire truck and too bad we whacked Mrs. Smith and Mrs. Smith is now in a coma. What can I expect to happen here to me, and what's going to happen to the fire truck and anything else?
If they're a good point, Tom, if there is a serious life-threatening injury or there is a death, Generally, the operator and even potentially the whole crew could be subjected to alcohol and drug testing. That's the first thing that most local jurisdictions will do. The next thing, as far as the apparatus will be put under quarantine by local authorities. And like we have said before, weight issues, especially if you have a lot of money and you want to buy a lot of brakes, springs, and tires, don't matter. None of this matters until it matters. Many states have chose to exempt fire apparatus from weight restrictions until something happens. So as long as you keep the vehicle on all 6 or 10 tires, it doesn't matter. But the minute that there's some kind of vehicle wreck, particularly when it involves the public and injury, the unit will be put under quarantine. Nobody will be allowed to touch it, and it will be scaled. And once it goes over the scales, it will probably be overweight, and that will be one of many charges that will be listed not only against the authority having jurisdiction, the fire department, fire district, but may go down to the driver as well. And certainly on the civil side of that, you're just looking to get hurt. Other things with weight issues. A lot of times the weight issues go way back to the design process. Who allowed this to be built like that? We're dealing with a department not too far from my house now that has an apparatus that's brand new. And at the 11th hour, somebody decided that it looked like it was a little heavy in the back. Maybe we ought to go weigh it. And as the apparatus sat without anybody in it, it was several thousand pounds overweight.
Well, you know, Mike, the weight issue is something that's it's probably been out there longer than anybody wants to give credence to. Again, the NFPA is now going to maybe kind of bring it to the forefront. We're going to take a quick break, and while I'm trying to gather my thoughts here, as the police are going to be asking me what kind of shape was I in and am I overweight and my fire truck's overweight, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan live from sunny San Diego.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects. We're here live at Firehouse World. If you do have any questions for Mike and Tom, please do send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Gentlemen, let's get into the second half of the show.
Thanks, Pete. All right. Well, hey, Tom's back, and thanks to Mike, my good lieutenant there, was talking to the police officer, and I passed all the tests successfully, so while I'm going to be off the driving list here for at least 2 weeks until the department investigation concludes, hey, I still got a job, so that's a good thing. All right, so let's get back into this weight thing. And why are we spending so much time on it? Because I think second to cab safety issues with people not being seated and belted, or with some of the units that Mike and I have seen where people are putting everything short of aisle 3 in the local Sears Craftsman store inside the inside their cabs. I'm firmly of the belief that this is the next most important major issue that we're facing with respect to overall apparatus design is overweight fire trucks. So here's a couple of things you can do beyond weighing everything of what you have in your fleet today. If you're buying a new piece of apparatus, a couple of thoughts. One is that you clearly need to identify, and this covers everything, brush truck, tender, engine truck, much more important on an engine and truck and a special service unit. You need to identify and have a reasonably close guesstimate as to the amount of equipment, weight, and payload that you're going to put on that unit, and give that information to the manufacturer or the vendors that you're dealing with so that they can properly design the unit. You know, some people may default and using the same line of logic in an engine in the power plant. If you ever had an underpowered unit, people said, geez, you know, the last unit we bought had a 350 horsepower unit, and it's okay, but it's a little marginal on a couple hills in the east end of town. So the next time we buy a fire truck and Mr. Fire Truck Salesman shows up, we're going to say, what's the biggest thing you make? And we're going to put that in. that's not the appropriate way to go handle your weight issue. If you have an overweight piece of apparatus, the standard shouldn't be for everything in your fleet you're going to put a 22,000-pound front axle and a 31,000-pound rear axle and run around at 53,000 and just thinking, okay, I bought the heaviest axles I've got, and I'm going to just hope and pray that I'm going to be covered for the life of the vehicle. You need to have a very good, reasonable guesstimate as to what your equipment payload is going to be, and if you're operating an engine, you need to have an idea what your hose capacity and your hose load is going to be, so the manufacturer can adequately calculate that and do a weight analysis, which is a pretty straightforward engineering computation, to look at what the weight is going to be on the front axle and what the weight is going to be on the rear axle in a completely loaded condition. Failing the fact that you take the time to figure that out and tell Mr. Fire Truck Salesman, Mike, what's going to happen is the manufacturer then is going to default to the guidelines of NFPA 1901, which on an engine company says you have to have a full tank of water, a full tank of fuel, the specified hose load, and depending upon the cubic foot storage capacity of the body, 2,000 to 2,500 pounds of tools and equipment. Now that might cover you if you're in a very rural area of the country, and if you're coming out of a rig where you're going to transfer the equipment from one unit to the other, and you're coming off a rig that had high side compartments and had six total compartments, that might cover you, right? If you're going into the rescue engine business or the squad company business or whatever the latest buzzword is, and you're buying a rig with seven full height, full depth compartments, and you're buying everything under the kitchen sink and hoping that Safer grant comes in so you can buy that new set of struts, then 2,000 or 2,500 pounds is not going to cover you there. And if you don't tell the manufacturer what you're going to carry, he's going to default to the number in NFPA. So if you load it to a capacity beyond that, now you're in a very gray area. You're starting to step into quicksand and not do well. Secondly, while this is probably not common practice with a lot of departments, but when the unit is delivered, prior to it being delivered from wherever you buy it from, all right, and it gets delivered to your community, that manufacturer should have a weight certificate where he has weighed the unit, as we described earlier prior to the break, front axle separate, rear axle separate, and then a whole thing together. And with a full tank of fuel and a full tank of water, he should be able to tell you what that unit weighed when it left the factory. Well, when that unit gets into your station, and before you accept and pay for it, you ought to take the time to put the tools and equipment in there that you were contemplating. Even if everything's not mounted, that's okay. Get everything on there, load it up with hose. Yeah, you're going to have to take it all off again, but we can't help you there. Get all of that tools and equipment and the hose load on there if it's going to carry hose. Make sure the fuel tank is full, the water tank is full. If it's got foam cells, you've got foam in there, or at least you've put water in there to compensate for that. And get the unit scaled and weighed, and make sure that it meets what the weight calculations, the weight estimates were that the manufacturer gave you at the time of the pre-construction conference, and make sure the unit is legal within what the individual axles and the total gross vehicle weight rating are. That at least will maybe help head off any issues or problems that you have of just assuming that everything's fine and dandy. You pay for the unit, and like in month 10 or 11, somebody says, hey, you know, before the warranty goes off, why don't we weigh this thing, you know? And then you may find out that then at that point, if you are overloaded, well, the ensuing time's gone by, you still might have a legitimate claim. Neither Mike and I are lawyers, thankfully. Hopefully there's no lawyers listening that are upset with that. But, you know, we're here to give you the best information so you don't get in a problem, or at least can position yourself that if you are in a problem, it can be identified early on. Mike, your thoughts. I mean, this to me seems to be, because I've put, as most of our listeners know, a fair amount of my work career in working for manufacturers, or things that sometimes you're, you know, I find myself in a position, I'm advising the folks you know, what to do. They just say, well, we're designing this rescue truck, and we want a 22-foot body. And when you ask them, what are you going to put in this 22-foot body, they'll tell you, well, everything that's carried on the on Rescue 2 downstairs, plus we're going to buy some more stuff. Well, what's that other stuff? If you can't tell me what that stuff is, you know, if it's rescue webbing and carabiners and rope for high-angle rescue, that's one thing. If the other stuff is going to be you're adding high-pressure and low-pressure airbags and a full complement of struts and a heck of a lot more shoring, that stuff weighs a lot more than the high-angle stuff. You need to transmit that information to the manufacturer. If you don't, again, you're starting to step in a quicksand.
Yeah, absolutely correct, Tom. The days of ordering a new fire truck, taking the old truck, unloading it in the apparatus bay, pulling it out, backing the new truck in, and then trying to decide what's going to fit where and how's it going to work out for you, those days have to be over forever. If you take the cost of a new truck, particularly an aerial ladder or tower ladder truck or a big heavy rescue truck, and you take the money that you spend on the apparatus and divide it by the square footage for the compartment space, you are paying more per square foot for that compartment space than people are to rent store space at the local mall. It's probably some of the most expensive real estate on the face of the earth. And with that in mind, you need to have some kind of plan. And something that we've talked about quite frequently when we're out speaking and lecturing is that you need to do the work up front. It takes X amount of work to design and lay out fire apparatus. The more work that you do up front, the easier and better and smoother it goes, and it's actually less expensive because then you start getting into change orders and things like that after the pre-construction conference when you found out that you've screwed it up. As far as the equipment, you need to have a plan as to what equipment is going to go in each compartment before the manufacturer ever cuts a piece of steel or aluminum for this truck. In the case of just taking new delivery, particularly with mobile water supply apparatus, years ago we were doing water supply classes, and we started to weigh tankers, tenders in the classes. And at one point we found a tender that was only emptying 71% of its water weight. In other words, what we did is that we completely emptied the truck. We weighed it empty, and this is something that you should do before you accept, particularly a tender, but any of your trucks. Weigh it, like Tom said, on each of the axles, okay, and then weigh the truck in totality and get those weight tickets, and then fill the truck up with water, and then weigh it again, and then empty the water. And like I said, we found apparatus that the truck's a 3,000-gallon tanker, and found that 700 gallons of the water was just being driven back and forth over the road. And you paid for a 3,000-gallon tanker, but you only have a 2,300-gallon tanker because you just keep driving the same 700 gallons up and down the road because it wasn't coming out of the truck. And that, in that case, it ended up being a problem with the baffling system and a design flaw in the truck that was easily remedied. But we would have never known about that had we not taken and weighed the trucks. One thing I think that we'll get into next month, just sitting here thinking about, how do you take delivery of a new piece of apparatus? What are those things that you can do as a department to protect your interest and the interests of the people that paid for the truck prior to accepting delivery? Things like hose testing and pump testing, those things just seem to not be getting done, and you may get a pump test certificate from the factory. And there's stories that are many and varied where what happened at the factory and then what happens in your backyard are two different things when it comes to the truck. So that may be something that will be explored next month on the show. But for now, with this weight issue, Tom, I remember we had a problem with the tanker trunk in my department, and it was a handling problem. And it was interesting what you told me that we should do. And how about that for our listeners?
Yeah. if you're weighing existing units, it's one thing to look at to say, is the unit legal in your community, in your state, in your locale, with respect to the axle weights? Mike and I are certainly sensitive to the issues that there are certain states here throughout our country, Connecticut and California are a couple that come to mind, where they have very stringent regulated requirements with respect to axle weights on commercial units, and where fire apparatus may or may not be exempt from that. In the state where Mike and I live, in New York State, other than the NFPA guidelines here with respect to weights, if you put a piece of apparatus in service, and other than the annual heavy truck inspection that the unit would go through, you could keep that fire truck forever. It could be grossly overweight, and you'd never know it. And certainly some of the communities that where Mike has done some work to look at the fleet, we found that that's has indeed been the case. There's units that people, in all good conscience, thought was perfectly acceptable and okay, and found out that the unit was either marginally or grossly overweight on the front axle or the rear axle, just sitting in a firehouse with not a whole lot of equipment on it in some cases, and no personnel in the cab. So some things you should be looking at from a handling perspective when you go to weigh it. If you have the ability, if you're going to weigh it like as people refer to it on police scales, you know, the unit from the left side to the right side of the unit shouldn't be much more than probably about 5 to 6% difference from one side to the other. That doesn't seem like a lot, but in a lot of cases, some of the handling characteristics have caused that. And people say, well, why is that the case? Well, take, for example, as Mike mentioned, a water tender or, a tanker back east, where normally the water tank would be a T-shaped. So you'd have the lower part of the tank or the tub, and then the upper portion of the T would be equal on both sides. Well, in some cases, we've done this to ourselves, both as the purchaser and the builder as well, to say, well, I want to have my either ground ladders or my portable water tank, instead of having it exposed outside on the body, I want to enclose it within the body. So what do? We, for example, lop off the left side of the T, and we slide our portable water tank in there so we don't need a drop tank device, and it just slides out the back. Well, that's great, but now the tank is not balanced. So we have more water on the right side of the tank than the left side of the tank. Okay, in and of itself, that's not an issue, but in the overall apparatus design, if you haven't compensated for that with either equipment weight or the way the body's designed to get some of that offset weight back over on the left side of the vehicle, people sometimes first notice it and it become just visually obvious before you even put it on a scale. They say, geez, when you look at that rig from the back, and not when you're loading hose, but when you stand back about 50 or 75 feet, it looks like, tanker 17's leaning towards the right. And then you kind of wonder why that's the case and say, it must be a bad spring or something. Well, then you look at how was the vehicle designed from the get-go, and in some cases, that just kind of got factored into the equation. So if any of our listeners have questions on this as you go out to get your units weighed, if you have things, please send any questions or queries that you have in to us at podcast@firehouse.com. Mike and I will be happy to answer them. This month in particular, because of some of the incidents that have happened with tragic accidents out in the field, a combination of some feedback that Mike and I have gotten through the website, or just some personal communications that we've had with folks, it certainly seems like this weight issue is, as they call it, up front and center, and is not going to go away. It's not the kind of thing, if you find an overweight unit, you just kind of hide it, push it in the back, and say, okay, we're just going to hope that we don't have to run this rig. Even if it's a second line or reserve unit, at some point, that thing is going to be ready to go down the road, and you need to be able to make sure that everything in your fleet is safe. Mike, any closing thoughts here before we wrap up today?
Yeah, all good points, Tom. As we go forward here, weight continues to be a troublesome issue. Not only face value, but hidden things like causative factors for accidents and maintenance issues, apparatus going through breaks every 3 or 4 months, broken springs, wearing out tires are all certainly indications of vehicles that are overweight or potentially overweight. And also, size matters. It's funny. It seems like the smaller the vehicles, the more higher propensity they have for being just overloaded and overweight. And so we want all of our listeners to go out there and try to weigh your vehicles and find out exactly what's going on within the vehicle so that we'll be roadworthy and streetworthy, and you can stay off the legal radar, so to speak. This is Mike Wilbur.
And Tom Shand, live from San Diego. I'd like to thank all our listeners for the program today. And again, if you have any questions or anything you'd like us to follow up with, please send those inquiries into podcasts@firehouse.com. Until next month, wish everybody to please stay safe out there, and look forward to seeing you soon. Take care.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.